6 years ago, Deborah Winger got so fed up with Hollywood that she walked away. She even signed her Screen Actors Guild retirement card. She taped it above her mirror so she'd see it every day. And finally, someone talked her into doing a new movie. Her husband, actor Arliss Howard. He wanted to make a film based on some short stories by Larry Brown, stories set in the North Mississippi Hill Country.
When the story's finished, they sort of detonate. On the surface, they appear to be about, you know, these guys who are without love, chasing love, usually in a car with alcohol. They're burning their lives down. They're, you know, looking for something. And underneath all that is this longing, fierce, fierce longing. And I identify with that because I live all my waking hours pretty much longing or confused.
Arliss Howard is the co-writer, director, and star of the movie Big Bad Love. It's the story of a hard-drinking Vietnam vet who's trying to make it as a writer and trying to get back with his ex-wife, played by Deborah Winger. She is also the film's producer. Steve Paulson sat down with Arliss Howard and Deborah Winger, and they talked about the stories and the music that inspired their film.
Come on, y'all. Come on down to Junior Kimmel's Juke Joint. Let's have a ball.
It was informed completely by Lafayette Marshall County in the North Mississippi Hill Country, but because it's so specific, it becomes a world and then is a larger world. The music that comes out of there is rhythmically so close to the way people move and the way that they speak, and it's almost as if there was a pre-existing soundtrack to the film before I actually discovered the bluesmen that come up out of the region.
Deborah, did you have this kind of visceral reaction to Mississippi, where you naturally
Steve.
Drawn?
No. Next question. No. My people generally don't venture south of the Mason-Dixon. So I was scared of Mississippi and Alabama. I mean, they really seemed like a world unto themselves. And after, you know, being basically taken kicking and screaming down there, of course, you know, as these things happen, I'm completely sold, you know, after having spent the summer there. And it's the people, my favorite thing that I've heard about it is that, you know, when you think about all the literature that has come out of the South, all the American literature, what would America be without the literature of the South, from Eudora Welty to Flannery O'Connor and Tennessee Williams, William Faulkner? I mean, it's almost ridiculous, like, you know, mm-hmm. And the way that we treat the South in our popular culture, you know, the Dukes of Hazzard,
right, right.
Like, never the two shall meet.
Yeah.
I always say one of my favorite scenes in the film is when these two guys who have just been driving around in a pickup truck covered with paint and are in a bar listening to, I think, Junior Kimbrough or R.L. on the jukebox, and, you know, the morticians are sitting next to them and they're drinking and they're talking about the Iliad.
Mm-hmm.
And when Southerners see that and people from Mississippi, they go, finally.
Little wordplay for you there.
You want a river? You try the Aeneid, book 7-8. God of the Tiber shows up in a dream.
We're in a few clicks north of the Tiber here, Bobby.
He says, Aeneas, you go down to the river, you're going to see a big white sow. The whole dream turns out to be prophecy by white swine. Start with the Iliad.
Arliss, the character you play in this film, Big Bad Love, is Leon Barlow. He's a Vietnam vet, a struggling writer. His writing doesn't seem to be going anywhere. He drinks too much. He's pining for his ex-wife, played by you, Deborah. There's a lot of emotional intensity between your two characters. And I'm wondering if it's easier to play those roles because you two are married in real life?
We just were divorced, Steve.
Just this morning. And we're doing so well with it.
I always say that, you know, in a marriage with any longevity, if you're looking at the long run, on, you know, pretty much any given day, you can access the divorce within your marriage. And that's not a bad thing. So,
because, I mean, I can actually imagine that it could go two ways. I mean, it might be a lot harder to play those roles if you live together in real life. I don't know.
I think the ticket for me is that we've been having a conversation for about 11 years now that ebbs and flows and modulates. And when we got down there to do this, it was just an extension of that conversation. the relationship as actors wasn't nearly as studied and precious as it might be where you're gearing up. You would just begin the work.
We were much more comfortable with manual labor, too. Have you noticed that when you and a friend or a partner are doing something together physically, you know, and I'm not talking about making love, but if you're gardening side by side, I mean, you can just have a conversation that you can't, something falls away that is treacherous in relationships. So the shooting of the film, I think we just didn't have time for anything other than communication.
I want to ask you about the music in this film, because it's great music, and it's not just a soundtrack, and this is not just background music. The music is really instrumental to the making of this film, it seems to me. Tell me about where this came from.
Well, the first connection into this, which is probably the most eerie in a way as I look back on it, was I had just been sent the stories in galleys in 90, right before the printing, I think. And somebody had said, you really ought to read these. They're very...
Larry Brown stories.
Yeah, the Larry Brown stories. And I was coming out of Nebraska into Missouri on a driving trip, and I had the radio on, and I heard this music that was just sort of literally stopped me by the time the song was over. This voice that was just this sort of, you know, desperate moaning howl, and this kind of ringing, repetitive, driving rhythm of a guitar behind it. I just found it so compelling, and I pulled over. I called them up. I said, what was that? And they said, oh, that's R.L. Burnside, Death Bell Blues. And I said, I've never heard of him. And they said, yeah. And so I went to a record store, and I found three or four copies of his work. One was an acoustic set called Mississippi Hill Country Blues, which is one of the great records that I have.
Well, I love you, little girl, and I love your husband, too. I'm just fooling your husband, babe, trying to get along, trying to get along, trying to get along. Trying to get along, showing up long.
So as you were then making the movie or writing the movie, the music was in your mind as you were doing that?
And I would give it to the people that I was collaborating with. Because rhythmically, and you're always talking about rhythm when you're making a movie in one form or another. You're talking about the rhythm of color, the rhythm of sound, the rhythm of the image. You know, everything is about rhythm. And this music just keeps coming. And I would also, Deborah, who wasn't making the same connections with music, would suddenly listen. Her favorite guy is Robert Belfer. To see her give Robert Belfer those herbal remedies for the flu when Robert wants a drink of whiskey is so wonderful to see him. Those huge hands pick up that little tin of herbs and kind of look at her beseechingly, you know. But she loved Belfer's stuff, and she would flash on some. She goes, that song. And so that song would be in the movie.
Oh, baby's gone. Oh, baby done left me. My woman is gone. I wonder where she be. I wonder where can she be. She gone and left me. She done gone and left me.
It seems to me the real subject of Big Bad Love is love, is the difficulty of love, especially when there's a lot of bitterness there. And how can you open up your heart when there's so much anger? Is that the way you see it?
Well, yeah, the challenge. I don't think you can avoid a bitter taste, but you know the difference between just chewing on it for the rest of your life or moving through it. But I feel like this is something I could never have understood when I was young. I just said, well, I'm never going to be bitter. Life is great, and every day is new, and all these doors are opportunities. And, you know, they tend to slam shut as you get older. And also you feel your mortality more. And I just think there's a lot more things to fight off in the morning when you wake up, like the heebie-jeebies, you know, and these demons. And some of them are real and some of them are imagined. And especially if you have a relationship that didn't work out the way that you hoped and you have children that you're raising, there's two choices for a woman, and I'm talking, I think, about 50% of our society, and I am an ex-wife as well as a wife, with a child from another marriage, where you have a choice. You either hightail it out, and you basically do it separately. He has his time with the kids, and you, or you still try to come around and see what you can salvage.
What are you
mangy looking thing?
What are you doing?
What do you mean? It's Sunday, p.m. I'm picking up the kids, just like the papers say.
I'm supposed to get a whole weekend.
I was supposed to get a whole weekend, Leon. It just didn't turn out that way. We got a late start.
I got a barbecue going. She's taking a nap.
I gave you a couple extra hours, all right?
They got to eat. Let me feed
them. It's going to rain. I want to get home. Please, don't
Why?
What do you mean, why?
What, you, is somebody coming over?
What?
You seeing somebody?
Oh, don't you do this. Don't do... Yes. Yes. I am. I'm seeing somebody.
As an actor, could you have played that role when you were, I don't know, 25? Or
well, I wouldn't have. I mean, it wouldn't have been right.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have always prided myself on playing age-appropriate roles, and that's problematic. When you get to your late 30s, they still want you to be perky. And I just think the sell-by date is somewhere a bit earlier, like, you know, how many chunky haircuts can you get? So I've just tried to find the age-appropriate roles. And, you know, this tricky area right now is like women putting on old age makeup. You know, there's famous stories, right, of women at 40, 45 playing 60 suddenly to get a good role.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just not going to do it. I'd rather not work.
Well, I find this whole, I mean, this shows my naivete about how Hollywood works, but this whole subject kind of bizarre, because I know, for instance, that one of the co-stars in this movie, Roseanne Arquette, is making this documentary called Searching for Deborah Winger because you
well,
had,
it's euphemistic.
Because you had dropped out of the movies for so long. And as I understand it, the film she's doing is about what happens to actresses after they turn 40. And for the rest of us, 40 is not remotely old.
I know, but look at the movies. They don't reflect that,
mm-hmm.
you know. And also there has to be sort of an anti-facelift campaign. It just has to begin. So I'm not starting it. I'm not saying I'm going to start it. I'm quietly, you know, fighting that battle. But we have to start looking our age and reflecting society in the movies. I'm saying we as if I'm still in it.
Is this why you basically quit the movies, what, 6 years ago or so? You just, there weren't roles out there that
yeah,
you
I mean, who wants to, you know, I like to have my food not chewed before I get to it, you know? It was pre-digested. I was reading pre-digested stuff. It wasn't even, I couldn't call it reading.
There aren't still good scripts floating, or a few good scripts floating around out there?
Sure. You mean for Hollywood movies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The problem with the Hollywood system is the script may start out good, but you know from, you know, reading everything everybody knows now, what happens to it. There's very many hands in the thing. There's chefs in the kitchen. There's, you know, it goes through channels that are commerce-minded, and so it tends to get a little ironed, you know, the wrinkles are taken out and the more than likely the realness and some of the harder truths. And then there's always that song that has to be tacked on the credit sequence to get the hit. And you know what I'm saying?
I think that in one form or another, this kind of, you know, complaint has been there for a very long time. It isn't just now. It's just that when the business of making movies was the movie business, which it isn't now, is a subsidiary of a larger concern, global conglomerates. The movie business reports to in a way that it didn't report to, even when it was reporting to New York back in the 30s and 40s, it was still reporting to movie makers. And the businessmen were movie makers. Thalberg was a movie maker. Zanuck was a movie maker.
It's not the truth.
Selznick
anymore.
Was a movie maker. That isn't the case now. It's the business of selling products. It's the business of tie-ins, commercial tie-ins.
You can't imagine product placement. When you talk about those movies, you say, do you read a good script? Yes, but then, you know because I'm jaded and I did it for 22 years that isn't going to be the problem on the set. The problem on the set is I'm going to look down and they're going to have a can of something in front of me and I'm, you know, going to sort of nonchalantly move it away from me because my character would never, and they're going to move it back. Now, maybe you can just find a place to just say it doesn't matter. But I don't think I will. I never did.
Deborah Winger and Arliss Howard talking with Steve Paulson. Their movie is called Big Bad Love. Tom Waits recorded two new songs for the film. Deborah Winger calls this one Long Way Home, The Ballad of Leon Barlow.
Well, I stumbled in the darkness. I'm lost and alone. Though I said I'd go before us and show the way back home. There are lies.